I hope everybody enjoyed Valentine's Day. Always thought it was a little bit strange that such a happy holiday is associated with and gets its name from a saint who ended up being beaten to death and beheaded by Roman authorities. Not exactly what most receivers and senders of Valentine's have in mind. Anyway, let's talk about what we are going to dedicate episode 91 to in the world of sports. We're not going to go with a single dedication or even a dual dedication. Instead, we're going to go with a dedication to a triumvirate of greatness. Three individuals who achieved the highest levels possible in their respective sports in the year 1991. And each of these individuals are true giants of their respective sports, easily making it on the Mount Rushmore of their sport and or position. So the first giant in our trio dedication is Mario Lemieux. In 1991, Mario achieved his first Stanley Cup when the Penguins bested the Minnesota North Stars. The signature goal of that entire Stanley Cup playoffs that year was Lemieux taking the puck and splitting what seemed to be the entire North Stars team on his way to putting the puck in the net. One of the most beautiful goals on the biggest of stages that you'll ever see in hockey. In fact, the Lemieux statue outside of the Penguins Arena in Pittsburgh, it captures that moment and that goal. The second giant in our trio dedication is Michael Jordan. Chicago Bulls won the NBA championship under his leadership, and he earned his second of what would become five league MVP awards. He was also the NBA Finals MVP in 91, and that year saw the greatest player in the history of the NBA perform right smack in the middle of his prime. The third and final of our triumvirate or trio dedication for episode 91 is Nolan Ryan. While pitching for the Texas Rangers toward the end of his career, he extended his own record for career no-hitters with his unbelievable seventh no-hitter against the Toronto Blue Jays. Nolan Ryan threw no-hitters in the 1970s, the 1980s, and in the 1990s. That's how you become the all-time career strikeout king. Still amazing to me that Nolan Ryan never won a Cy Young Award. As I've mentioned, Lemieux, Jordan, Ryan, they are on those Mount Rushmores of hockey and basketball and pitching. And what was cool from my perspective was that watching all of them perform in 1991, it came with the realization by sports fans that they were indeed watching three of the greatest ever at their craft. So we were able to enjoy them with a full understanding of what we were observing. And that's not always the case in sports or in life. You know, sometimes you realize things after the fact or too late that maybe you should have known at the time. But with those three, and in that year, we knew exactly what was in front of us. Thus, episode 91, it's dedicated to the trio, the triumvirate of 1991 greatness in the world of sports, Mario Lemieux, Michael Jordan, and Nolan Ryan. Because the time tends to fly on each episode of a content-packed Far Middle podcast, let's get right to making those connections and linking up dots to, again, mimic the technique used by Dr. James Burke in the BBC television docuseries Connections. And we're going to jump from the three examples of sporting greatness that we opened with to connect to the subject of human ingenuity greatness. There's an example, a case study out there in the real world that exemplifies greatness and the glory of achievement through human innovation that is the equal to what Jordan did on the court or Lemieux did on the ice or Ryan did on the diamond. In fact, what I'm about to discuss, it exceeds any of those three individual greats by a measurable degree. Because what I'm about to discuss, it's impacted the lives and the well-being of billions of human beings over the past 200 plus years. The best way to describe the achievement that I'm talking about is to think of a chart or a graph. So on a simple graph on the x-axis, the horizontal axis, you've got the metric of time. And we can run that axis from the start of the Industrial Revolution hundreds of years ago all the way through to present day. And then on the y-axis or the vertical axis of the graph, you could choose a number of different metrics to plot. You could plot up their life expectancy in terms of average life expectancy for humans on the planet for each given year over that period of time. You could plot infant mortality rate. You could plot standard of living on average for a typical human over that period of time and how it's changed. Or you could simply plot global population, you know, which in many ways is a result of some of those prior metrics I just mentioned over the time, again, from the start of the Industrial Revolution to now. And every one of those graphs and every one of those lines, whether it's for life expectancy, infant mortality rate, population, standard of living, you pick it, but every one of them would show a steady and significant and marked improvement from the start of the Industrial Revolution to today. Yeah, there would be bumps, right, in the progression over that period of time for that chart, and that would be reflected in things like world wars and so on. Yet the lines over time will trend in a quite obvious direction, with life expectancy and standard of living and population, those are hockey sticking upward over time. And then, of course, infant mortality rate is hockey sticking in a downward direction over that same period of time. So, you know, what were the causes of all this benefit to the human condition since the advent of the Industrial Revolution? Well, in reality, there are going to be many contributors that had significant impacts, and most, if not all of them, are going to be falling under the category of innovation and disruptive technology. It's basically the ability of humans to advance the state of the art and turn what used to be something that controlled humans or harmed humans into something that humans controlled for the benefit of themselves. Pharmaceuticals through chemistry, that's a great example, with R&D formulating chemical compounds and the drugs that they're encapsulated in, and then using them, of course, to cure all kinds of different ailments and conditions and diseases. I think advancements in agriculture, that's another significant contributor. You got fertilizers and seed science and irrigation techniques that have greatly improved crop yields, which of course are going to improve the supply and the cost and the nutritional content of food that humans consume. But the single biggest contributor, without a doubt, it's mankind's ability to manufacture and harness the power of the carbon atom through energy. The mighty carbon atom and fossil fuels, those are the single largest contributors to why life expectancies have skyrocketed since the Industrial Revolution, and why infant mortality rates have plummeted, and why income per capita and global populations have skyrocketed. And the impact and benefits of the mighty carbon atom become even more apparent and pronounced when you start to develop these graphs nation by nation. So the United States, which was one of the key drivers and innovators from the Industrial Revolution to today, it shows an even steeper curve when it comes to these key metrics moving in all the right directions over time. And nations or areas of the developing world that have not enjoyed the benefits of the carbon atom, or nearly to the extent that the United States has enjoyed it, their conditions across these metrics, they may have improved, but for the most part, only to a fraction of the extent that we saw improvement in places like Europe and the United States. And one of the coolest realizations that you come to when going through this type of exercise is that wherever the original innovation started from, sure, that was certainly where the biggest and most immediate benefits were realized, but the benefits quickly spread to other regions and nations and parts of the world to extend beyond where the benefits were much more widespread. And in most instances, and certainly in the instance of carbon and energy, those benefits that were realized were truly global. And of course, these innovations and these technological breakthroughs, they were achieved by humans most often in a certain type of an environment that served and nurtured an ecosystem for people to achieve. So that ecosystem would be a government of republican democracy. It would be an economic system that embraced a free market and capitalism, and it would be a culture where individual rights were of paramount importance. Lo and behold, many of these great innovations, including energy and fossil fuels, they were developed and they were demonstrated in places like the United States and Western Europe, places that embraced those types of characteristics that I just mentioned. And this leads me to the next connection to make. So a couple of hundred years of human progress and experience in republican democracies that are capitalistic and free market based, where individual rights reign supreme, it leads to really good things. Fossil fuels greatly expand life expectancies, pharmaceuticals drastically reduce infant mortality, and agriculture advancements, they greatly improve per capita incomes and overall population. But what do we see today when it comes to these developments and advancements along with the things that nurtured them? Today, we see an attacking and an assault on the values and the institutions and the innovations themselves and what they bring with respect to all these benefits bearing across the globe. Last year, during the COP27 conference in Egypt, you had elites and bureaucrats from hundreds of nations convened to talk not about how we further turn loose the ability of humans to achieve, but instead how to best penalize and attack and eradicate the very things and the very characteristics that made those benefits and things come to fruition. The primary focus at COP27 was applying reparations theory based on fossil fuel consumption. The idea here is that Western developed nations accrued more of a benefit through the utilization of carbon and fossil fuels through the years, and that now they should pay for those sins of innovation and utilization and pay reparations to the developing nations across the globe that have not enjoyed the same level of benefits tied to energy and fossil fuels through the years. Now, it appears to be an insane concept on its face. Well, because it is. Why in the world will we want to penalize and vilify situations or advancements like the harnessing of fossil fuels, where humans or nations have brought an innovative force to the world with improved things like life expectancy and growing population and reduced infant mortality and drastically improved individual rights? We need more of those things and more of those situations, not less of them. We need to celebrate them, not vilify them, and we need to find ways to continue to expand and grow them, not shrink and eradicate them. Philosophically, this whole idea of reparations tied to energy use or carbon utilization or things like climate policy, it smacks of trying to pull down the success in order to make things more equal or make things worse across the board. Instead of what we should be doing, which is setting pathways and policy to help pull up the areas that might be lagging to make things better overall. This approach is the antithesis of a meritocracy, and it's surely going to demoralize the innovators, not motivate them, and that's not going to be a good thing. And there's another problem with the idea of energy or climate reparations beyond the flawed philosophy, and that is that there is no scientifically valid or engineering sound alternative from carbon to provide reliable, affordable, abundant energy to the developing world that currently doesn't enjoy such things. As we've discussed many times on this podcast, thinking that the world can windmill or solar panel its way to a zero carbon economy where energy is abundant and affordable and reliable, that's a fairy tale bordering on ignorance. It won't happen because it can't happen under the laws of science. The most efficient path to energy security for all, it's utilizing more fuels like natural gas and utilizing more things like nuclear, not less. Anyone who thinks different truly needs to reference a high school chemistry, physics, and economics trio of textbooks. Heck, when you think this whole issue through applying plain logic, if anything, the world's nations, whether they're developed or developing, north or south, rich or poor, they should be thanking the individual and the innovator and the disruptor for bringing the gifts that the carbon economy and fossil fuels have delivered to mankind over the past 200 years running. Our lives have become longer, we've become richer, the air's become cleaner, and we are smarter than we ever would have been without reliable, abundant, and affordable energy like natural gas. So, to all of you working in and with careers in the natural gas industry, or domestic oil, or the pipeline industry, or the power generation industry, I've got a message for you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you from a grateful host. Thank you from the grateful people who are in the know because they've done the homework. And thank you for those, for whatever reason, who haven't done the homework and they're not in the know for their gratefulness and what you brought to bear. Okay, getting a little fired up about energy policy and this concept of climate reparations, just a silly concept. Let's turn it down a notch, but also take the issue of climate reparations and connect it to our next thought, which is how energy policies across the globe, and including the United States, they continue to punish the success and reward the politically favored. I came across a big example of this at work in Georgia recently that I wanted to share with all of you constant listeners. Just start with the bigger picture when it comes to energy in the United States and climate policies. On one hand, these policies and regulations, right, they attack and they stifle and they cancel private sector infrastructure investment into things like natural gas pipelines. And we discussed on a few recent and prior episodes of the Far Middle as to how two pipelines that we were planning to build from Appalachia into the southeastern United States were either canceled or have been held up for years because the whole of government attacked these types of domestic energy private sector infrastructure investments. And if you recall, we discussed how bizarre that type of behavior was because it justified or was justified by the government and by environmentalists as necessary to help tackle climate change. But the scientific reality was that building those pipes would have a tremendous benefit to reducing carbon dioxide emissions within the United States to the magnitude of over 400 million tons between those two pipelines. That's because, of course, the more natural gas utilization is growing in regions of the country like the Southeast, it would help displace coal, which emits higher levels of carbon dioxide for power generation. But there's also a second side to this whole of government meddling with energy decisions across the nation. And that's what is desired to occur in lieu of the free market driving infrastructure investment into things like domestic natural gas pipeline infrastructure. And that second side manifested in a recent announcement for Georgia. This gets to our story. Now, the headline that I read that initially got my attention on this topic was, Georgia gets big solar investment. Well, the veracity and the accuracy of that headline when compared to the reality, it truly is going to depend on how flexible one is with the definition of investment. You see, there are a couple of significant details that matter greatly if you wish to understand what's occurring with our vaunted energy transition and with our attempt to tackle climate change. Because first, the investor or entity that is driving the investment in solar manufacturing in Georgia in this story, it's a South Korean multinational, multi-billion dollar conglomerate corporation, which means any profits from the endeavor are ultimately going to be offshored away from the United States. And then the second issue that matters greatly speaks to why the large South Korean corporation is making the investment in solar manufacturing facilities in Georgia. It comes down to over $560 million in tax credits a year. That's right, over $500 million a year in tax credit subsidy is going to be paid to a South Korean multi-billion dollar global conglomerate corporation. And that's right as well, over $500 million a year in tax credit subsidy, it's going to be paid by the American taxpayer. And that's code typically these days for the middle class worker. Now you put on top of these facts the reality that solar power generation is expensive, it's intermittent, and it's got a tremendous carbon footprint on a life cycle basis. And you quickly realize in very stark fashion the ugly reality of what the vaunted energy transition and the effort to tackle climate change truly represent. They're an epic and massive effort that results in historic levels of corporate graft. Legal graft, statutorily created graft, but make no mistake about it, no matter what angle you view it from, the essence of these policies, it's not to save the planet, but instead it's designed to enrich the special interests and the favored political classes. Yeah, going back to that headline of Georgia getting a big solar investment, it makes you think, once you had a chance to assess the facts, as to how that headline should have read under a more objective lens. Something like over $500 million a year appropriated from the middle class to offshore conglomerate corporation under the protected graft of U.S. climate policy. That might have been a more fitting headline. Another great example of why I would never have made it in the media or journalism game. This massive appropriation of value from the middle class to the favored corporate class that we just discussed in Georgia with solar got me thinking about our next connection, and that deals with the price of one of the most vital products the world knows, which is natural gas. And the price of natural gas, more specifically, in the once great state of California. Because we saw a massive disconnect between the price that Americans pay outside of California for vital natural gas and the price that Californians are subjected to in the state for natural gas. It was an amazing dichotomy that serves as a naked quantitative example of the consequences when governments, whether they be state or national or in increasingly common instances global, when these governments or government entities chase climate policies with the whole of government behind them. So let me give you some data and details about natural gas in California. First, realize that California, despite all of its code red proclamations, it remains heavily dependent on natural gas for its energy needs. Two-thirds of the homes in California are heated with natural gas, and almost a third of natural gas is utilized in California, and it's being used for making electricity coming from power plants. So natural gas continues to play the major role in keeping Californians warm and making sure Californians have lights and that they can charge all of those electric vehicles. Then there are the data when it comes to the price of natural gas in California. In January of this year, and the data that I'm looking to here were for the first half of January, Californians were paying on average just shy of $20 per million BTU of natural gas. That's 500% or five times what the Henry Hub benchmark for natural gas was trading at during the same period of time of the first half of January of 2023. That's right, Californians were paying five times more for vital natural gas than what the Henry Hub index said natural gas should be selling for. That's not good for families. That's not good for the working class. That's not good for business owners or for any other stakeholder that is a doer in the state of California. And another data point that was striking was that December of last year, prices for natural gas in California, they were, once again, 500%. There's that magic number, or five times higher than December in the prior year in 2021. So it's not just more expensive to live in California versus other parts of the country because of energy policy, but it's also getting incredibly more expensive within California as time goes on. And the last data point that was interesting is if you look at the level of natural gas production in California, because California was once a great energy producing state, you'll find that natural gas production has been cut in half from what it was 10 short years ago. A decade under the whole of government approach, with California attacking its own domestic energy industry, it cut production in half, which, as we all know, when you crimp supply of a product, inevitably it's going to drive up its scarcity and its cost. And when that product is energy in the form of natural gas, something that everyone in California utilizes, the pain's going to be suffered by all. The Mamas and the Papas, their most famous and biggest hit single was California Dreamin'. Well, when it comes to energy policy in the year that is 2023, California Dreaming has become quite the nightmare of the energy transition. But you know, what's going on in Georgia with solar and federal energy policy, and then what's going on in California with natural gas and state climate policy, all of these things, they started with a push from the global elite, expert, bureaucratic classes. They created this unhinged fervor that we see with Code Red and the need to act now and tackling climate change and the energy transition, much of it steeped in mythology that's frankly bordering on a religious zealotry. And going back to the root proponents, I'll call them, of this mess when it comes to energy and climate, and seeing how some of the results of following the prescriptions, the policies, they're creating some very ironic juxtapositions. That brings us to our next connection, because now I'd like to talk about what our friends at the World Economic Forum have done with a survey that predated the recent Davos confab a few weeks ago. Again, the World Economic Forum is the creator and the sponsor of the Davos meeting held each year in Switzerland of the global elite and the expert classes. And now going back in history with Davos, you would find year after year one consistent drumbeat of a theme above all others. And that was the view that climate change is the biggest existential threat facing humanity, that we're in a code red situation, and that there is an answer through an energy transition that will be smooth and beneficial to all. That theme wrapped around the essence of just about every Davos meeting in the past 10 plus years. And this is where it gets interesting. The World Economic Forum conducted a survey of many of the attendees at the Davos meeting in 2023, just before they showed up in Switzerland. Sort of get a sense as to what the elites and the experts were thinking before they showed up, and to help promote the overall Davos theater. And what did the survey find? Well, the elite and the expert and the bureaucratic classes, they're worried. And what they're worried about is high inflation, high energy prices, and high food prices. They felt that those three things together, they sort of presented serious threats to global stability over the next couple of years. Okay, so a couple of things here. First, I agree with the survey findings. Yes, inflation is a massive global epidemic and problem that threatens to make a whole range of other issues much worse in the coming months and years. And energy and food inflation are particularly more harmful and more worrisome developments within the overall inflation rate itself. People have to eat. People have to use energy. Rich or poor, developed or developing, it doesn't matter. Energy and food inflation hit everyone. But of course, it hits the most vulnerable the hardest. So Davos crowd in the pre-Davos survey, they got it right as to what should present and constitute a wall of worry in 2023. But where the Davos crowd got it wrong was failing to self-reflect on these survey results and thinking for a moment about what the root cause of them might be, and thus what the root solutions to mitigating these stressors might be. And if they did that, and they were being honest with themselves, they would quickly come to the conclusion that the root cause of global inflation and food insecurity and energy insecurity are the very climate policies and energy policies that the Davos crowd advocated for and strong-armed in support of for years. Heck, you can add to that list of inflation and food and energy costs things like the invasion of Ukraine by Putin and China increasingly being on the prowl across Asia. Those are additional symptoms of these energy and climate policies developed, marketed, and advocated for at places like Davos and by the attendees at Davos. So the past year, it's offered clear evidence that Davos man and Davos woman may represent the single biggest risk to humanity in the near term. Sometimes I get the feeling that if we canceled the annual Davos escapade, it would be an instant upgrade for the condition of humanity. That's about it for episode 91. We made our sports dedication for this episode to the year 1991 and those three greats, that trio, triumvirate of greats who accomplished awesome things in 1991. Yet 1991 was also an epic year when it came to the world of alternative hard rock. That's a genre that I particularly like and enjoy. 1991 was about as big of a year as it gets for that genre, and in many ways, that year reset and recreated alternative rock into something exciting and new. So just consider the list of albums that hit the airwaves in 1991. You had Nirvana's Nevermind. That's when grunge was born, of course. Pearl Jam's 10. And I can't believe it's been that long ago that that album came out. REM issued their Out of Time album. That weird video for Losing My Religion, it was considered high art, still considered high art to this day. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, they had Blood Sugar Sex Magik. They haven't changed a bit in 30 plus years. And the Pixies, they had Trompe Le Monde. That's the greatest band that most people never heard of. If you're not familiar with the Pixies and you like alternative and rock, I think you'll like them. Check them out. And then last but not least, U2, the great U2. They came out with their epic Octoon Baby album, the best U2 album ever as far as I see it. In 1991, by the way, also the year that the first website went live on the World Wide Web. That's crazy. That makes me feel old, and I probably feel old because I am old. Anyway, here's your homework assignment over the next week. Speaking of the World Wide Web, log on and spend some time on nickdeolias.com. Tell me what you think about some of the commentary and thought pieces that are on there. And feel free to follow me on Twitter, @NickDeolias. I'm always posting thoughts on there daily. And buy that book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, if you haven't had a chance to yet. All the net proceeds go to the CNX Foundation's Mentorship Academy. It's a great effort and great cause. Now, those things, they'll keep you busy over the next week, constant listener. And until this time next week, I wish you all the best.